I'm off. Okay, now I'm on. Okay. Hi, do I need to go back to the whole handkerchief routine again? No? Okay. All right, so verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. We need to pause on these two verses because these are pivotal texts in the chapter of Genesis chapter 1. And as a matter of fact, they're all about us. This is something which Moses sets out as being completely, utterly unique about human beings. Notice that no other creature, the sun, the moon, the fish in the sea, the creatures that crawl around the earth, the water and the land, no other creature which is mentioned in all of Genesis 1, none of them ever get this statement, that God made them in his image. It's only the human being that is created in the image and likeness of God. And so notice how Moses, as he is structuring his chapter, he is telling us that God created the land and the sea, that God created the larger light to rule the day, the smaller light to rule the night, the birds which fill the sky, the animals which fill the earth, the animals which fill the sea. He has told us about all the vegetation, all the trees, all the plants that have come up. And all of these things, Moses said, God saw that they were good. But of only one creature, the man, does Moses say that that creature was created in the image and likeness of God. Some people have wanted to say some nonsense here that since the singular man is used here, that the image and the likeness applies only to the male. But let's get rid of that nonsense right away, shall we? Notice verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Notice that what Moses clearly tells us in verse 27 is that when Moses uses the term man, we're to understand it here as the generic human, right? So that man here is being used as human, and it is the humans, both genders, male and female, which have been created in his image. So this is not gender specific. Moses is not being sexist here. This is a declaration that the human being, both genders of the human being, male and female, are created in the image of God. What is maddening here is that Moses really doesn't do much more except to say that that's true. And so Bible readers have been scratching their heads for centuries trying to figure out what in the world does it mean to be created in the image and likeness of God. We see that that's the case, but what in the living daylights does it mean? Before we get into that, I want us to take a look at one verse in order for us to see clearly the implications of the reality that we're created in the image and likeness of God. Keep a finger in Genesis chapter 1, but we need to go to a New Testament book, the book of James, back towards the end of the Bible, just before the book of 1 Peter. James comes right before 1 Peter and right after Hebrews. And then find chapter 3, and we're going to settle in verse 9. But before we get to verse 9, I want you to see that what James is talking about in all of chapter 3 is the way that you use the most powerful part of your body. You know, weightlifters want to tell us that the most powerful part of your body are your legs, right? You get on a weight machine, and it's amazing how much more weight you can lift with your legs than with your arms. Weightlifters want to spend hours building up their leg muscles or building up their arm muscles or trying to build up other portions so that they can demonstrate the muscular build which is available to them through working out. But that's not the part of the body that James wants to characterize as the most powerful part of your body. There's a part of your body that can destroy a human being. There's a part of your body that can exalt a human being. There's a part of your body which can bring down nations, and James is giving his attention to that part of your body in chapter 3. It's your tongue. It's that little piece of flesh that flails around in your mouth. And James' point is this. Your tongue can raise buildings, or it can lower them. Your tongue can build a nation, or it can destroy a nation. Your tongue can lift up and exalt a person, or it can completely abase them. Your tongue, what you say, is a mighty, mighty item. Notice verse 5. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. Ever wanted to take something you've said back? Ever said to yourself, I would give the world to be able to take that back? Have you ever told someone, take it back? Or have you been told by someone to take it back? The power of the tongue is without measure. All kinds of animals, verse 7, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. So you work hard enough, you can tame a lion. You work hard enough, you can tame an elephant. But you cannot tame the tongue. Its power, its strength is mightier than that of an elephant. With the tongue, we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. We want to look at verse 9 as our central text to get started this morning. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Notice what James is saying here. Human beings are not to be the objects of your tongue's wrath. Human beings are not to be the objects of your tongue's cursings. Human beings are not to be the victims of the lashings that you can produce with your tongue. Human beings are not to be the target of the arrows that you shoot forth with your tongue. Why? Because they're created in God's image and God's likeness. In other words, what James is telling us here is we may not understand what it means precisely to be created in the image and likeness of God, but whatever it means that these creatures, above all other creatures, are not to be the targets of your abuse. And here James is emphasizing they are not to be the targets of your language abuse. Why? Because they're created in God's likeness. Go out and yell at a tree. Go out and speak arrows at the sun or at the moon. They're not created in the image and likeness of God. But do not abuse a human being with your tongue, because it is sacrilegious. It is unreligious. It is irreligious. It is perverse, and it is pagan. Because a human being is created in the image and likeness of God. So use your tongue in relationships to other human beings for purposes of edifying and building up, but not for the purposes of cursing. Now, of course, we can extrapolate here. If we're not to abuse people with our tongues, then we're not to abuse them physically. We're not to abuse them emotionally. We are to recognize that human beings are with inestimable value. You cannot count the value of a human being because, not because they're good looking, not because they're talented, not because they may have a large bank account, not because they've made a contribution to society, but because they're created in the image and likeness of God. So in other words, all the ways in which human beings are valued and prized in our society have now been kicked out the door. A contribution that a human being makes to society is no longer a basis upon which you value that human being. The degree to which that person is a good parent is no longer the ultimate value of a human being. The cleanliness of that person, the appropriateness of that person's dress, the degree to which that person is well-kempt, the intellectual brilliance of that person, the degree to which that person is talented, a good speaker, a good actor, a good singer, a good pastor, a good businessman, a good mother, a good military person. All those are now vanished. They are excused from the stage as the reason, the fundamental reason why we value a human being. We now value a human being simply because every human being is created in the image and likeness of God. This is a Christian distinctive, which is mind-blowing and world-reshaping. It would be very interesting if we were to do a test here that I used to do when I was teaching an ethics course at Laternal University. In that ethics course, what I would do is I would assign a group project, and the group project had to do with making some decisions. You were given a list of people that you could take with you to a desert island, and each person had certain things about them, and you were to make choices about who lived and who died. And you now had to make choices about who lived or who died, who you took with you and who you left behind, based upon these descriptions. These tests are very revealing because they end up showing our basic prejudices about people. They end up showing and making very clear our basic preconceptions about people and the baseline by which we value people. What James is telling us is that the reason why you value human beings is because not of anything that they have done, not because of anything about them, but because of something God has done in relationship to them. He's created them in His likeness. So now what we want to do is we want to talk about a little bit, all right, we know that what the implication of being created in God's likeness is, but what in the world is it? I don't know. But I'm going to try to help us make a guess this morning. So let's go back to the book of Genesis, and I want you to read with me once again Genesis chapter 1 and verses 26 and 27, just so we have the text of Moses in our minds. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness." And then notice verse 27, so God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. So keep a finger there in Genesis chapter 1, and let's go to Genesis chapter 5, just four chapters later. And what we're going to try to do here is we're going to try to get an understanding of what it means to be created in the image and likeness on the basis of how Paul, how Moses uses that language elsewhere. So in chapter 5 of Genesis, we're in verse 1. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. At the time they were created, he blessed them and called them man. See, there's Moses making it explicit. The term man back in Genesis chapter 1 is the generic term for humanity. They are man. Man and woman are man, not just the male. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son. Now notice this. He had a son in his own likeness. I would have just been fascinated to find a 130-year-old man having a son. This just would have been a kick, right? So he had a son, notice, in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years, and then he died. Well, I'll bet he did. After 930 years, what in the world else are you going to do? I mean, this is just it. So what I want you to see here is what occurs in verse 3. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. Do you see what Moses is doing here? He's giving you a little insight into what it means to be created in someone's image and in someone's likeness. See, Seth was in the image and likeness of who? Adam. See, Seth was in the image and likeness of Adam. And what was Seth's relationship to Adam? He was Adam's bingo. Now you know what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God. To be created in the image and likeness of God is to be identified, to be given the privileged relationship out of all other creatures to be God's children. That's what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God. If you are in the image and likeness of someone, Moses is telling us, you are that one's child. You're his son or you are his daughter. And out of all the creatures that God created, out of all the creatures that were good, only one creature has the relationship with God whereby they are able to declare and to see themselves as God's children. That's what it means to be created in the image and likeness of God. It is a relational term. And so in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, when Moses says that human beings were created in the image and likeness of God, this is just a long and convoluted way of saying simply one thing. Human beings are God's children. They are related to God uniquely out of all creatures as his kids, his sons and his daughters. So that you can just imagine with that, what God is now saying in James chapter 3, verse 9, when he says, look, don't curse your brother or your sister with your tongue, because that's God's kid. Now, you know that Pamela and I love our little Silky Terrier, Gracie. We adore our little Silky Terrier. But you know what? She's not created in the image and likeness of God. As much as that hurts me to say it, it's true. Gracie is an adorable creature, but she is not created in the image and likeness of God. She's not God's daughter. As I was walking to church this morning, I saw an adorable West Highland Terrier getting his walk. He wanted to come over to me, and he wanted to say hello, and he was absolutely adorable, and I love Westies, but Westies aren't created in the image and likeness of God. You may be a person who is... Who loves the trees, and you may spend hours in your garden, pruning this, trimming that, watering this, fertilizing that. And you may have the most beautiful, luscious garden, but all those trees and all those plants are beautiful, but they're not the sons and daughters of God. You see, what Moses has done is to identify uniquely one creature who has the privileged relationship of being God's sons and God's daughters. And that's simply us. We uniquely are God's kids. And so you can just imagine the amount of responsibility that is upon other human beings to be properly related to other human beings. Don't treat your sister like that, God is saying. When you use your tongue, God says, don't treat your sister like that. Or when you use your tongue, God is shouting from his heaven, don't do that to your brother. When you're driving along Central Expressway and someone cuts you off and you've got a few choice words or perhaps a physical gesture, God says, don't do that to your brother. That's my son. Don't you dare do that to your brother. When you and your spouse are involved in a discussion, or let's be real, argument, and you are about to say something vicious with your tongue, God says, don't you speak to my son or to my daughter that way. That's your sister. That's your brother. Don't you dare treat your brother or sister that way. You see, all of a sudden, being created in the image and likeness of God is a privilege, but it carries with it a huge responsibility. We have so many ways of valuing each other, but there's only one godly basis of value, and that's the way in which God has created us. So that's at least part of what it means, right, to be created in the image and likeness of God. But notice that when Moses tells us what God said, something else comes right after that. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 1 and notice verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. Notice that as soon as God says that the human being is in his likeness and in his image, they are given a responsibility. Notice what that responsibility is. To rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. Are you getting the picture here? To be created in the image and likeness of God is not merely to be given privilege, but to be given what? Responsibility. To be created in the image and likeness of God is a double-edged sword. It comes with privilege, but that privilege indicates responsibility. The first responsibility is to make sure that you're treating every other image bearer as the valuable son and daughter of God they are. But the second responsibility is that you are to rule over the rest of the creation. In other words, you're responsible for the rest of the creation. You're responsible for the fish. You're responsible for the trees. You're responsible for the West Highland Terriers. You're responsible for the rest of the creation, because the other thing that it means to be created in the image and likeness of God is to be placed over them all. And what you should be thinking about here is the ancient family. The ancient familial structure was this. You are the firstborn. You are the firstborn of God. And the firstborn in the ancient world was always the heir of all of the father's possessions. As a matter of fact, he was the one who was given the responsibility of caring for the household when the father was on a trip or when the father was out of town or when the father passed away. The firstborn was set over in order to be the manager of the house. And that's what Moses is telling us has happened here. To be created in the image and likeness of God is to have been placed over the household of God in order to manage it, in order to take care of it, in order to be responsible for it. Notice, you're supposed to rule over all the other creatures, but you're not supposed to rule over each other. You see, you're supposed to rule over the animals, you're supposed to rule over the plants, you're supposed to rule over the earth, but you're not supposed to rule over other image bearers. No image bearer is supposed to rule over other image bearers. Now, there can be a hierarchy, there can be a structure in which organization is needed in order to see that out, but no image bearer bears the image more than any other. Notice what else goes on. Verse 28, right after verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish and the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Notice again, as soon as Moses talks about being created in the image and likeness of God, again the command comes to rule over the rest of creation. There is a difference between you and a fish. There is a difference between you and a tree. There is a difference between you and the dirt. And you are given the obligation of ruling over those things. But notice, there is no fundamental difference between you and another human being. You're all created in the image and likeness of God. And God is denying the fact that there is anyone in this room more worthy, more valuable, than any other person in this room. So, to be created in the image and likeness of God means fundamentally to be his child or his daughter, to have been given this privileged relationship with God. That's the privilege. But with that privilege comes a huge responsibility to value each other and to care for the rest of the creation. To value each other and to care for the rest of the creation. So let's talk a little bit, shall we? What are some of the ways in our societies that we frequently end up valuing other people apart from the fact that they're created in the image of God? What are some other measurements of value that are prevalent in our society? We value someone because X. Because how rich they are. Yeah. You always do. Absolutely. Righteous indignation pops in when human beings are abusing other human beings. And the righteous indignation pops in when human beings are not valuing the one in whose image we are created. Right? So righteous indignation, I can think of three immediate general places. One is when a human being confuses themselves with God. Right? When they don't see themselves as the image bearer, but rather as the image giver. So when a person is not worshiping God, but worshiping him or herself, this is the place for righteous indignation. Two, when a human being is abusing another image bearer. That's a cause for righteous indignation. When we run across a pedophile, this is a perfect place for righteous indignation. We never, ever put that person in a context in which he is responsible for children again, and we are righteously angry and we deal with this person. An abusive husband, an abusive father, an abusive wife, an abusive mother. I mean, you all are familiar with the story that just happened back in August of 2005, right? Where a mother takes her baby, places the baby into a microwave. This is a cause for righteous indignation, because here is an image bearer completely desecrating another image bearer. And thirdly, there is righteous indignation when we are not conducting ourselves as responsible rulers over that which God has given us. When we abuse an animal, this is a case for righteous indignation. When we are allowing our natural resources to be depleted in a thoughtless way, this is a case for righteous indignation. When we are not being good rulers over the creation, this is a case for righteous indignation. I can think of those three, and I think those are the main three. Not being rightly related to God, not being rightly related to each other, not being rightly related to that over which we've been given responsibility. So when I go fishing without a fishing license, banish the thought that I would ever do that, but if I were ever to do that, park ranger comes along, slaps me with a fine, throws me in jail for a day, that's entirely proper. I find out that there's a neighbor next door who is keeping his dog tied up to a stake outside 24 hours a day and not feeding or watering this dog. This is a case for righteous indignation. So, okay, I've got money, right? This is one way in which we value. How else do we value?
Beauty,
appearance, right. How thin a person is, how slim a person is, how attractive a person is, absolutely. Yeah, what else?
Fame.
Yeah, how famous a person is, how well accomplished they are. And you can tell this just by the number of magazines that sell at our grocery stores about how Hollywood is doing. The lovely people. Dallas is known. You know, Dallas is known worldwide for being a city of beautiful people. We live in a city that values people by virtue of their appearance and by virtue of their fame. L.A. is even more that way. New York can be that way. And so absolutely, fame, appearance, how else?
Talent,
yeah. And you know, this isn't limited to just non-Christians, right? Christians can value other Christians based upon their talent. You know, it discourages me deeply when I ask my students where they go to church, and you know they answer by telling me the name of the pastor. I go to so-and-so's church. See, that's not the way in which we identify our churches. The way we identify our churches is by means of the community, right? By means of the community and the group that is there. But unfortunately, evangelicalism has become a place in which we identify values by personalities, and that must never ever be. How else do we value human beings?
Race,
absolutely. And y'all been reading the paper and the websites recently. As much as it's tried to be publicly kept under, it is being argued now that race is clearly going to play a role in the next election. Race, absolute ethnicity. How else? Gender. Yeah. We're seeing a lot of this in just the current political climate, aren't we? Race is an issue of value, with the choice of Governor Palin and the rejection of Senator Clinton. These are gender issues. People value and ultimately value other human beings on these bases. I'm sorry, I heard one just a moment ago.
Political views.
Absolutely. By the way in which you're registered and by the way in which you vote. I just heard the other day that at a seminary, If I were to tell you the name of the seminary, you would know that an argument broke out between two staff members over political views. And I'm using the term argument lightly, right? Yeah. Theological views. I remember when I was a student at DTS, I was coming out of one of the office buildings there and headed over to the student center. And there were these two guys, almost as tall as I am, but a whole lot. They were talking, and then they started yelling, and then all of a sudden, one student just decked the other one right there. Two Dallas Seminary students right there. Pow! Just landed him on the floor. Come to find out later, they were arguing over election, the theological question of election. One had taken a very strong Calvinist position. The other person had taken a less, so more moderate Calvinist position. Bam! Just knocked him to the floor. Yeah, I heard that one of the guys who teaches psychology actually applauded the event and said, "Finally, Dallas Seminary students aren't holding their hostilities in." How else do we value people? I'm sorry. Okay, absolutely. And there are biblical guidelines for what kind of sexuality is proper, but we need to make sure that we're not confusing sin, right, with image. Sin always perverts the image. Sin always mars the image, and we need to call sin sin. Whether that's fornication, whether that's adultery, whether that's homosexuality, we need to call sin, sin. But you don't make perversity obscure the fact that this is a person created in the image of God. What else? Age. Absolutely. We're seeing this in the current election. Age becomes a factor. And the way in which we treat aged people, so that we're sometimes very loud on valuing the fetus, but sometimes we're not as loud on valuing the aged and making sure that those people who are too old to care for themselves are receiving the same kind of care that we would give to someone between those two extremes. What Moses is saying to us is that we ultimately value a human being. Our basic reason for loving and adoring a human being is the fact that they are created in the image of God and they have innate value regardless of what else you may see in them. And fundamentally, this boils down to the reason why you stay together in marriage. Right? So that no matter how hard it is to live with your spouse, no matter how irritated they make you, this is the reason why you don't get divorced. This is the reason why you don't throw your kids into the road. This is the reason why you stay together, why you work together, why you struggle with each other. It's because ultimately we adore each other and we're loyal and faithful to each other. Because you're either God's son or God's daughter, and God has created us in His image. This is a revolutionary principle for why human beings should adore each other. Well, can we covenant together this week to be a group that when we see someone this week, our first thought of them will not be their appearance, their wealth, their status, their gender, perhaps the particular sin which they're committing, can our first thought of them be, this person is created in the image of God, let me love them appropriately. Sometimes the right way to love somebody is to tell them they need Jesus Christ. Sometimes the right way to love somebody is to tell them they really need to stop destroying themselves by continuing in that behavior. Sometimes the right way to love somebody is to get down your knees and hug the stuffing out of your 5-year-old little boy or your 5-year-old grandson. Sometimes the right way to love somebody is to say a word of kindness to them. Can we just pray that when we see someone this week, we'll recognize, first of all, that they are God's son or daughter, and then pray that God will give us the wisdom to know how we are to love them and value them at that instant. Could we make that covenant together? Let's pray together. Father, for your mercy upon us by the Spirit to be those who value human beings according to this teaching, that they are in the image and likeness of God. And by your Spirit, would you give us the wisdom to know how to love them in the moment in which we encounter them? I ask it through the Son and by the Spirit. Amen.